I love children. Exciting, this congregation has so many little ones. And one of the reasons I want to go to heaven is because that's where all the children will be. You ever thought about that? There'll be no children in hell. In fact, one of the things that will make hell hell is the lack of little ones that will be there. When it comes to passing values on to our children and raising children, I love the poem called The Sculptor. I took a piece of plastic clay, idly fashioned it one day, and as fingers pressed it still, and it molded and yielded to my will. I came again when days were past, the bit of clay was hard at last. The form I gave it, it still bore, but I could change that form no more. I took a piece of living clay and gently formed it day by day, and molded with my power and art a young child's soft and yielding heart. I came again when years were gone, and as a man was a man I looked upon. Still that early impression wore, and I could change him never more. It is certainly true that children are important, and that you and I, being around children, not just their parents, but all of us that can be mentors to them, we have a great opportunity to influence them in a very positive way. And we have this special window of opportunity where we can especially make a difference. I love the saying, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. And that is just as true today as it was centuries ago when that phrase first was penned. I'm fascinated by the Catholic Church and how for a long, long time they have boasted, give me a child for the first 5 years of their life, and they will be Catholic for the rest of his or her life. I'm absolutely not certain what they do during that time period to make that boast. But they certainly are showing the importance and the value of the early formative years. And I believe when we talk about this subject of instilling religious belief, that we need to not think about just sort of babysitting our kids and taking them to church and keeping them quiet, but determining what we can do to influence their thinking and to impress them about the importance of God and worship. Indeed, children are so important. But sadly, Flavel Yeakley reports in his book, Why Churches Grow, that on average, approximately 50% of our young people, our own children, fall away. Perhaps this congregation has better odds than that. I don't know. But when I reflected years ago on the congregation I grew up in, that pretty much was accurate. That's really tragic. That parents oftentimes are unable to disciple their own children successfully. You know, the most critical part of a relay race is the passing of the baton. Oftentimes the competition is stiff and both teams are running as fast as they can and it's really nip and tuck. But if somebody drops the baton and the runner has to stop and pick it up, they'll almost always lose the race. And when it comes to the kingdom of heaven, we have approximately 18 years, typically, where our children are at home with us. And then we send them out into the world. I sometimes think of parenting as being similar to shipbuilding. That you spend a lot of time and money and effort building a big ship in port. And then you send it out and christen it on its first journey out on the waves all around it. And how it handles the storms, and whether it holds up, often has to do with how well the ship was built. And the same thing, I think, is true oftentimes with our children. That passing of the baton of faith is what we want to end our series with this weekend. How can we certainly do better than 50% on average? I do want to say something, though, before I leave the wrong impression. Do we have a big influence on our children? I hope so. But there are many people who make wrong choices even though they had good examples and good parenting. And we also have examples where people had very bad parenting but still made the right choices. The Bible is filled with characters like that. Hezekiah, Josiah, basically all the righteous kings of Judah had fathers and oftentimes grandfathers that were idolaters. Even Abraham came from Ur of the Chaldees and came from a background of idolatry. And in spite of that background, they repudiated it and chose instead to do what is right. So I want to make it clear that ultimately this is your child's choice, and it is not a foregone conclusion that if you do everything right, that the fruit that you desire is going to come about. Even Jesus lost Judas, and obviously Jesus' discipleship was perfect, right? So I just want to keep that in mind, because sometimes I have lessons like this and really good, godly people just really grieve in their hearts about maybe what's happened to their adult children. And sometimes I think maybe beat themselves up unnecessarily and in ways that will discourage them. And that is not my intent here at all. Okay. How do we pass our values on to the next generation? We are important role models for the next generation. And I think oftentimes things are more caught than taught. Just simply by observing certain things, we wind up having a large influence on all of those around us. I really like what Polycarp, the first century martyr, is famous for. He told people in his day, preach the gospel to all around you. Use words if necessary. Shows the importance, again, of his life and influence. But we are living in a different age than certainly in the 1950s, for example. I was fascinated to find in the research that there were four top influences on children's values in the 1950s. By far, the number one influence in the 50s and even 60s was the parents, their family of orientation. After that, it was their peers, who their friends were, the crowd they ran with. After that was the media, TV, magazines, radio, newspapers. And in number four place was institutions such as schools and churches. Now, in the 2000s, that's sort of been turned on its head. In the 2000s, on average, by far, the typical family, the number one influencer of a child's values is the media. Not just TV and magazines and radio, but of course, the internet and websites and iPods and iPads. The average child in America spends 7 hours a day in contact with the media. And sadly, much of that is controlled and is putting out propaganda that is of the world. And unless you're very careful to counter their exposure to the media and the music they're plugged into and that kind of thing, you're just basically allowing the world to introduce to them adult themes and ungodly entertainment that will destroy their childhood innocence. And I hope all families of today will have filters on their computers to keep out pornography. So the media can be our friend in some instances, But sadly, it has become the one primary influencer of public opinion and of values in America today. After that is people's peers. Be careful whom you allow into the sanctuary of your soul. You will share their destiny for good or for evil. I mean, young people especially want to fit in and, you know, be somewhat popular if they can. And based on the social norms of the group that they run with, that has a lot to do with their values and their choices in life. I think one of the reasons for the local church is we're to be an oasis from the world, a point of light in the middle of darkness, so we can associate together and be edified and encourage each other in things that are right and sort of be a countercultural influence. And then in America, typically, parents rank third place when it comes to influencing their children and their values. Frankly, a lot of that's because parents and children are all kind of like running their different directions, and they don't eat dinner together tonight, and there isn't a lot of meaningful communication on the feeling level. They're like two ships passing in the night. And so parents that used to have the primary influence, if nothing is done to do something differently than the norm, parents have the third place influence as far as values are concerned. And then finally, fourth still, is institutions such as schools and churches. So what does that say about our Bible class program? Is it important? Absolutely. But it should be a complement to what is done at home, because the primary influence about instilling faith is what happens on a day-to-day basis. So, I tell people all the time, you know, I don't want you to have a typical family. I don't want you to have an average family. The typical average American family is a mess. Why would you want to be like that? So if you're going to be significantly better, in fact, perhaps outstanding, then you're going to have to not just go with the flow. You're going to have to do things differently than most families do. And those are some of the things we're going to be talking about in our lesson tonight. Parents have to do a lot of things, but certainly these two things. As I mentioned, you have to be especially diligent to monitor media exposure, because that can so quickly pollute someone's mind. Remember Proverbs 4 and verse 23. Keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues or the springs of life. Secondly, watch who their friends are. Consider Proverbs 13, verse 20. He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companions of fools will be destroyed. So don't let your children just run with any kind of crowd. One of the things that my parents did for me and that we did for my children is we tried to encourage our children to always know it was okay to invite their friends to come home with them. So if they were in our house, we could meet them and know who they were, and we could better monitor things. My children actually thought that was pretty cool, and my wife was a pretty good cook, and we would often feed them while they were there, but we wanted to know who our children's friends were, and we encouraged them to have friends that are Christians and people that would help them get to heaven. How do you instill religious belief in children? I want to make it clear that when I'm talking about this subject, I'm not just talking about how do you get your children to be well-behaved and to develop the habit of attending church services. I mean, that's okay, but that's not necessarily conversion, is it? How do you instill religious belief? You need to remember that God wants churches of regeneration. Churches that are born again, not just churches of generation. You don't want people to just sort of, you know, become churchgoers because that's the way they were raised. And it really doesn't go a whole lot deeper than that. One of the things that concerns me among brethren is that frequently you'll be in a group and someone will say, well, are you religiously? And they'll say, well, I'm Baptist or Somebody else says, I'm Methodist, and then the other person says, well, I'm Church of Christ. Brethren, we want to be simple Christians. I don't want to be a hyphenated Christian. There's no such thing as the Church of Christ Church. To use that kind of terminology, it's really denominational. And yet, typically that happens in people that are sort of raised in the church. And sometimes they talk about them being Church of Christers. Boy, talk about nails on a chalkboard. That is not biblical. That is confusing to people when we try to tell them. I think a proper answer would be, I'm just a Christian, nothing more, nothing less, and I do my best to be a part of the church you can read about in the Bible. Now, that's going to bring about a good discussion. But to answer those kind of questions appropriately means that you've developed your own understanding and your own faith. We need to have that in our own vocabulary, in our own thinking, as well as when we talk to our children. I told my girls, don't just marry a churchgoer. Marry somebody that is devout in their faith. Now, you want to make sure that you're not just on autopilot out of habit. I'm blessed that I've been going to church 3 times a week since 9 months before I was born. That's true. My parents were good, avid churchgoers. My father, an elder in the Lord's church for close to 30 years. It's not a big deal for me to just do what I always have done, and that's attend church services regularly. I could do that, but not necessarily have my own faith. And it's important that we have our own faith. And I think it is really awesome that this congregation has so many first-generation Christians. Because there's just really a sense of perspective and joy when someone has really had to struggle with the truth and then rejoice that they have found it rather than having it handed to them on a silver platter. How do we really instill belief? Remember, we love grandchildren. That's a picture of my sister Becky and Wilson Copeland with one of their grandchildren. And by the way, many of you know J.D. Copeland, who works with Don Bunting up in the Manhattan Church in New York City. That is their son. So J.D. Copeland's my nephew. So there's a lot of connections here, isn't there? So how do we go about instilling belief? We first must recognize that God has no grandchildren. This is not something you just teach them to have some sort of habit. And you don't just give them pat answers. You try to help them to develop their own understanding and their own faith. That is so critical. Abraham is a good example. He, of course, is a friend of God and the father of the faithful. And one of the reasons why God thought so much of Abraham is because, in Genesis 18, 19, he commanded his children and his household after him that they may keep the way of Jehovah and do righteousness and justice. Wow, that's a wonderful thing to behold. One of the things I love about the Bible is how so many things all blend together. And in the last book of the Old Testament, in the book of Malachi, it says, one of the signs of the Messianic age is that the fathers will return their hearts to the children. In other words, if you really are born again of God in the water and the Spirit, you men especially are going to have a heart for children. And not just your own, but the children around you, just as Jesus had a special place in his heart for children. Put his hands upon them and blessed them and said, to such belongeth the kingdom of heaven. And so any faithful congregation is going to want to do things that will encourage helping each other provide the spiritual needs of children. Listen to Isaiah 54, verses 13 and 14. It says, all thy children shall be taught of Jehovah, and great shall be the peace of thy children. In righteousness they shall be established. You see, in the Old Testament, children were, the men at least, were circumcised on the eighth day, and then later on they were taught to know Jehovah after they'd already partaken in the Abrahamic covenant. He says, in the new covenant, the new kingdom, no one's going to have to be taught to know Jehovah because only those who by faith come to him will come into the kingdom anyway. All shall know him. And when they come to know the way of righteousness, He says, your children will have peace. And that is so true. When you see children that are really godly, where there's just a peace there in their eyes and in their hearts that hopefully will continue on throughout life. So how do we go about passing the baton of faith on? Passing on values. Well, there are three aspects I want to look at. First of all, I'm going to look at the definition of values. Secondly, how can we effectively pass them on? Then I want to interweave all of this with some practical suggestions that I hope you'll find meaningful. So how do you define a value? Mr. Webster, help me out. According to Merriam-Webster's dictionary, a value is those benefits to which we attach worth. And of course, some have higher rank than others. Consider Proverbs 22 and verse 1. A good name is to be more desired than great wealth, and favor is better than silver or gold. So it doesn't mean that silver and gold don't have value. They do. It's all a relative thing. They are not as important as your reputation. So, as you think about what's important to you and what are your values, how would you list them in your own life and family? Values focus on four different areas, typically. One area has to do with experiences. Lots of Americans just really look forward to different types of experiences. They just live for that exotic vacation or that period of recreation. And of course, there's nothing wrong with that. The question is, how does that fit in your list of what's really important? Experience has value, but it should not be your most important value. I'm personally a little disturbed about how many people can't wait to retire so they can travel and play golf, and they'll have this long list of all these wonderful things, and I'll say, okay, nothing wrong with that. But if you have 20, 25, maybe 30 years in retirement, are you going to retire from the Lord's work? Are you going to view this as an opportunity to really perhaps be hospitable and save souls and just be more accessible and available to what really matters? I'm not saying you can't have some fun and recreation and take some trips in your retirement, but sometimes in local churches, we need people to teach, and some of the older folks will say, oh, I paid my dues. So the young people who already are busy and have families at home and all that wind up doing all the teaching, while a lot of folks that could teach don't because, well, I guess they kind of hung it up. I just don't think that's right. And I think we need to really, again, assess what really matters. That kind of retirement is, by itself, just very worldly and, frankly, shallow. Now, some focus on relationships, and that's good. Some really value romantic relationships, and I certainly do with my wife. And others value more familiar family relationships. And we ought to tell our children that people are more important than things. And one of the reasons I value my family is because, well, first it comes naturally, but secondly, I know that God has told me to value my family. And that is one of the ways we can please and glorify God. Others focus more on money and material things. And what they're interested in is hard, cold cash. It's difficult in our world, particularly as men, not to associate our self-worth with our net worth. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, having a nice home and those kind of things. But we need to make sure that we don't sacrifice spiritual things in order to have those things. And then there's those who focus on truth and things that are spiritual as the primary value. I think of Proverbs 23 and verse 23, where we're admonished to buy the truth and sell it not. And of course, we're mindful of the pearl of great price, where the man is willing to sell everything that he has in order to get this pearl. And the pearl is clearly salvation and a right relationship with God. It's been said that below average people focus on things, average people focus on other people, but above average people focus on ideals and ideas, particularly how they relate to things that are eternal. I'm sure you're here this afternoon, back for a second service that you're not used to having anymore, because you value things that are spiritual and value truth, and I appreciate that very, very much. So, what are your values? Our top values ought to be knowing and loving God, which correlates with the very first and greatest commandment, that we're to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. One of my favorite memory verses is Jeremiah 9, verses 23 and 24. Let not a wise man boast in his wisdom. Let not a mighty man boast in his might. Let not a rich man boast in his riches. But if anyone boasts, let him boast in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who exercises loving kindness and justice and righteousness on the earth. For I delight in these things, declares the Lord. That was one of our family memory verses, and our children need to see that what we delight in most is our relationship with God. And our children need to see that in us. That's amazingly powerful. I heard about three young boys who were together, and boys like to brag on their dads. And one boy was saying in the group, "My dad knows the mayor." The other boy said, "Hey, that's nothing. My dad knows the governor." And the third boy over here, whose dad was apolitical, didn't know what he was going to say, but then finally he thought, "Well, my dad knows God, the creator of the universe." And his father did. Isn't that a neat thing for a child to brag about in regards to his father? And what a wonderful thing to encourage him to know God as well. So, assuming you know what your values are and they're in the right place, what does the Bible say about passing those correct values on to the next generation? Well, there's actually a section of text that deals with this specifically. Deuteronomy chapter 6. Now, these are the commandments, statutes, and ordinances which Jehovah God commanded to teach you, that you might do them, that thou mightest fear the Lord thy God, to keep all his statutes and his commandments which I command thee, that thou and thy son and thy son's son, all the days of thy life shall be prolonged. Notice, passing it on to your children and your grandchildren and ultimately to your great-grandchildren. Hear therefore, O Israel, and observe to do it, that it may be well with thee, and that ye may increase mightily, as the Lord God of thy father hath promised thee, in the land that floweth with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, soul, and might. And these are the words which I command thee this day, that shall be in thy heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thy house, when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thy hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes, as you write them on the post of thy house and upon thy gates. So let's exegete this passage and see what we can learn from it. How do we pass them on? Obviously, the very first thing that is stressed is you do this through example. He says very clearly, these are the commandments and the statutes and the ordinances which Jehovah God commanded to teach you, that you might preach effectively? No, that you might do them. In other words, these are given for your own daily lifestyle choices that you live before your children. How do you pass them on? You pass them on by modeling these things before your children. That is just so important. People would rather see a sermon than hear one any day, right? I think of Acts chapter 4 and verse 13. When they beheld the boldness of Peter and John, they took note that they had been with Jesus. And so their time with Jesus had transformed them, and Jesus had discipled them by living out the Christian life, as it were, in their presence. Acts chapter 1 and verse 1, Luke says, "I wrote these things unto thee, most excellent Theophilus, about the things that Jesus began both to do and to teach." So Jesus wasn't just a teacher. He was a doer who lived the perfect life before us. One thing is certain, is there is no substitute for godly living. Power of example is just an amazing force. If we could, let's participate for a few moments together in a little game. Do this for me, kind of clear the deck a little bit. And what I'd like you to do is I want you to take your left hand and I want you to put it about 2 inches above your left knee. And then on the count of four, I want you to bang it down hard on your left. You ready? 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, I want to make a couple of observations. I asked you to take your left hand. Some of you did. But most of you looked up at me and saw that I had taken my right hand. So you didn't do what I said, you did what I did. And then I said, 2 inches. It's very specific. But most of you didn't do what I said, you did what I did. I was at least a foot high up here, right? And then I clearly said, put your hand down on the count of four. I did three, and most of the slaps were on three and not on four. Once again, you didn't do what I said, you did what I did. Now, what is more powerful, what we say or our actions, what we do? You know the answer, don't you? When I was a teenager, I was really struggling with some things. Being in the LA City schools was not an easy thing to do in the early 70s. And there was a lot of peer pressure on me. And I remember getting up one night about 11, and I was getting something to drink. I noticed the light was still on around the corner in the den. And I peeked around, and there was my father sitting there with the light on, studying his Bible, and he was clearly praying. And I stood there for what seemed like minutes, it was probably 30 seconds, but I didn't want him to see me checking him out. But here he was in his private moment studying and praying. I remember just walking back to my bed and laying there at night thinking, he's so sincere and real about his Christianity. And there were times where I did the right thing, not because I was a person of such good character, but because I didn't want to disappoint my mother and father. Now, later on, of course, it was more I wanted to make sure my own relationship with God was right. But when I was sort of weak in my faith, it was the tremendous example of my father that really gave me the strength to stay more pure. And I always appreciate him for that. And I hope that all of us as children can, as parents who raise children, can make sure that we understand that as well and appreciate the importance of our example, and that it is true, most things that are most important are caught rather than taught. But you just pick it up because that's the way the person lives. How else do we pass these on? Well, through instruction. Obviously, teaching has something to do with it. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 7, "And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children." The word here is the word for sort of formal instruction, what I'm doing right now. There's a place for that. The root word for that is to whet or to sharpen the appetite, which tells me we're supposed to teach these things creatively in a way that is interesting as much as possible. So one of the ways you teach your children is maybe having, you know, devotions around the dinner table and periods of time that you do your Bible lessons together, where you have instruction in God's Word. But notice what else it says. For thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thy hand, and thou shalt be as a frontlet between thine eyes, and write them on the post of thy house and upon thy gates. The idea is this becomes a part of who you are, not something peripheral, but something central, so much so that when you look at your hands, you think about God's Word. That when you look at life, you do so not through rose-colored glasses or through the world's view, but through the lens of God's Word. And that perspective changes everything. And even when you walk through the threshold of your house, up on your gate, you see that this is a house that belongs to God. Me and my house, as Joshua said, we serve the Lord. So our values are supposed to reflect how we act and how we live. So how do we pass them on? We pass them on also by discussion. The word in verse 7 is different than the word we looked at earlier. Thou shalt talk of them. Now, this means that there are periods of formal instruction, but there are also times where you are just making them a part of the conversation, where you talk of them normally as you look for teachable moments. So one of the ways we pass on values is through informal communication. And he tells us that we look for teachable moments just whenever we can. He then talks about the idea of spending time with your children. I want you to notice verse 7. Thou shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house. Do we take time to just sit in our house and talk? When thou walkest by the way. In Bible times they didn't have cars or Uber, obviously. And so they would walk most everywhere they went. And so I like to think of this as when thou ridest down the road. Is that a time to have family time and to talk? Versus always having to have the radio on or, God forbid, headphones on in the back seat, completely cut off from the front seat. And when thou liest down and when thou risest up. Really important that we spend valuable time with our children. Not just quality time, but quantity time. You know, this idea of I'm going to fill my whole life primarily up with my career, and then I'm going to take 7 to 8 in the evenings, and that's the quality hour I'm going to spend with my children. And so you're exhausted, and you rush in, and you sit your kids on the couch, and you go, okay, 7 o'clock, this is our hour together. Children don't talk on demand. They don't talk on the clock. My wife said that when she would take my kids on field trips and she was often available to drive my children and their friends different places, that it was amazing what they would talk about in the back seat. And my wife would come home and say, you won't believe it. And it was all the conversation that was going on in the car. My wife wasn't eavesdropping, and the kids weren't trying to say something to keep it from her, but she was plugged in to what they thought and what they were doing, and she learned a lot about things simply because she looked for opportunities to be with them. You shall talk of them when thou sittest in the house. You know, someone said that, you know, you can't lead a horse. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And that's true. But you can put salt in their diet so that they're thirsty. So that they'll want to drink, right? And I think sometimes that's what we as wise parents need to be doing to make things interesting and to do things in a creative way so that they will ask questions and be intrigued. And that's a very important part of spending time with them. And you shall talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. One of my fondest memories is the times after dinner where my family and I would go for a neighborhood walk. And one of the reasons we'd like to do that is not only is the exercise good for you, but what happens when you go for a walk with someone? Well, you talk, right? You have a conversation. And some of the neighborhood kids would realize that the Hunter family was out taking a walk, and they'd want to join us. So I felt sometimes like Pied Piper, you know, all these kids in the neighborhood joining Brent and Gail as we're walking down the road. And we would have really meaningful discussions. And oftentimes it's only 25 minutes, probably 30 at the most. But it was sort of a tradition. And it was a time where we would ask them questions and enjoy family time together, sometimes with them and the neighborhood kids. So you can spend time with them by literally when you walk us down the road having discussions. And it also says when thou liest down with them. One of the things I miss most about having an empty nest is that it was my job as the dad to put the kids down to bed and to say a prayer with them. And I'd ask them what was going on during their day, and then we'd pray about that. And I did this all the way up until the time they were in, you know, high school. And I especially did that up until just almost college with my youngest daughter, Allison. And I just missed that time together. You dads, if you are not kind of tucking your kids in and using that as a time to talk with them and to pray with them, you are really missing out. And you can build relationships and build bonds that can make a difference. I remember one night, Amy was kind of wound up and she was having a hard time getting to sleep. So I said, why don't you let Dad snuggle up with you? So she said, okay. So it was a little crowded because she had a little single bed, but I kind of got into bed with her and she snuggled up next to me. And I said, Amy, tell me about your day. She went and told me about her four-square game and all the different things that, you know, a 6 or 7 year old thinks is exciting. And and I went through and listened, and then she says, Dad, tell me about your day. And I said, okay. So I started telling about my day and what I was going through, and about 30 seconds later, she's snoring. I guess an adult life is not very interesting to a 6 or 7 year old. But that put her to sleep, like sometimes I guess I can do when I talk. But it was just really neat to maintain that connection with my children. And if you're not interested in asking questions when they're 6 and 7 and 8, you're not going to have the open communication when they're 15, 16, and 17, and they're going through some serious issues that they need your input on. I think it's so amazing that he talks about all these different times, when thou sittest in thy house, when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. We had a tradition in our home where the kids were small, we try to get together around, you know, breakfast, then we'd start off with, you know, good morning hugs when we woke up. When I was gone in meetings, my kids used to say, we miss our good morning hugs, and I'd have to make it up to them when I got back. So that's kind of a family value, just the idea of being affectionate and showing warmth one to the other. Spending time with them is very, very important. And I'm wondering, how do you pass your values on? I want you to notice that in the back of your notebook, I have some information about Bright Tapes. www.brightkids.com. You know, the second most important relationship that children often have is with their grandparents. So those of you that are grandparents or about to be grandparents, I really recommend you consider buying these audio files for your kids to download and to use because they instill wonderful values. Most of the music out there, sadly, is negative. These are great examples of things that are very, very positive. I particularly like the Standing Tall series. It deals with obedience and self-esteem and work and courage and love and service. When my girls were small, we used to hop in the car, and back then they had cassettes, and they'd grab which cassette they wanted to play. And we kept them away from the, quote, top 40 popular music just as long as we possibly could and plugged them instead to a cappella singing and these really fun break tapes. It's children talking to children with full orchestration and with really catchy tunes. My two favorites were Dependability and the Land of Obey tape. And I remember Amy, 6, 7 years old, walking down the hall, just singing underneath her kind of mouth, saying, "I was where I said I'd be. I get 100 in dependability. I did what I said I'd do. I'm dependable through and through." I mean, what a positive set of lyrics for a child to be thinking through and for you to enhance with them as you talk about these things. I think it's real important that instead of just sort of keeping people completely away from the media, which is not very realistic, take advantage of the fact that there are lots of things out there that are good alternatives, and you provide them with these alternatives. Lots of really well-done a cappella music CDs. And there's something known as the Gospel of John on DVD that is just the gospel itself narrated that really gives you a good impression of the Gospel of John and is fun to watch and to discuss. I love the PC Study Bible as a really neat tool that is helpful. There is a website on Bible.ca put together by Brother Steve Rudd. You can just get lost in that website and all the information it has in it. And there's some movies, frankly, that are pretty decent. My wife and I went last year to see War Room. It was about prayer. It's really meaningful. It's another movie called Woodland, which is about the football team and what happened when a bunch of them were converted to the Lord. There's a movie out called God Is Not Dead, and they just recently had a sequel to it, God Is Not Dead 2. There's another one called Risen, a recent one called Is Genesis History? And though occasionally there are some things you may want to discuss that you may differ with, you're talking about spiritual things, and you're filling their mind up with theological thoughts that are so much better than the typical sitcom or the typical trashy movie that is out there today. So, how do you pass these things on? You do them in ways that avoid dogmatic lectures. I think that's important. Some kid comes home from school and says, "Mom, Dad, is it always wrong to lie?" If you're not careful, you might quickly just say, "Well, yes, of course. Lying is an abomination unto Jehovah, and he that deals truthfully, however, is his delight." That's what Solomon said. Of course, it's always wrong to lie. And this student goes, "Oh." And the problem is, you never really got the underlying question that was troubling the child. It would have been better to have said, "That's an interesting question. Why do you ask?" Draw the child out. "Well, my teacher brought up a situation dealing with situation ethics and gave us several scenarios where it appeared that it was really okay to lie, and I'm just puzzled about that." "Well, okay, let's talk about it." And then you help your child to process what was going on. And you're able to discuss what's on their mind. And then you deal with the dilemma. Then you affirm the truth. Help them to see the fallacy, watch the wheels turn, and then they say, "Oh, I get it. Thank you, Dad." Then maybe you give them some verses. See, now they're developing their own faith. they've thought it through instead of just given a dogmatic answer.